Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to the Yaron Brook Show. I'm Don Watkins, sitting in for Yaron Brook. I'm a fellow at the Ayn Rand Institute and co-author with Yaron of the forthcoming book, Equal is Unfair, America's Misguided Fight Against Income Inequality. So for most episodes of this show, we focus on big economic social issues like inequality or foreign policy. And that's certainly important because one of the ways that we pursue our happiness is to try to create a world in which we can pursue our happiness. But I think there's also a danger in focusing on political or social issues too much, and that's it's easy to lose sight of objectivism as a tool for success and happiness, that what we can fall into is viewing it as a cause. And so I wanted to talk today about objectivism as a tool for success and happiness, and to do that, I want to bring on a guest, which is Alex Epstein, a former fellow at the Ayn Rand Institute and now the head of the Center for Industrial Progress, as well as the author of a really amazing book, The Moral Case for Fossil Fuels. Alex, are you with us?
I am. How's it going?
Good. Thanks for coming on.
So yeah, looking forward to it.
Yeah, I want to get into some of the lessons you've learned running your own organization, but I wonder if you have any thoughts at the outset about the difficulties and challenges in living by a philosophy and some of the mistakes that you see people making.
Well, it's a big issue, so we'll probably go into a lot of specifics, but I'd say there's a lot of challenges in living, period. So you can, if you're trying to live by a philosophy, you can experience it, through that attempt. You know, you're trying to live by a certain set of principles, and you're encountering a lot of difficulties. But I think in general, it's a lot easier to live with a philosophy than without a philosophy. So we can talk about some of the ways in which a philosophy can be misunderstood or misapplied. But I talk to enough people that I'm really grateful to have a lot of philosophical guidance. And even when I don't think I knew how to use the philosophy as well, it's just so much better than not even thinking about what you're doing in your life and why. And those are the kinds of questions that a philosophy causes you to reflect upon.
So one way in which I think people go wrong, and I mean, I've definitely seen this, and I mentioned at the outset treating objectivism as a cause, and I think one way you put it that I've heard in the past is treating objectivism as a hobby. And can you speak to that kind of phenomenon as distinguished from actually living by a philosophy?
Interesting. The last time I spoke about this, publicly at least, it was at the Strive/ARI event, which was a couple months ago, which involved mostly a lot of students and was a really interesting event. And I remember describing it as objectivism is not a club. So that's sort of the latest way that I've thought about it. But let's see, it's not a hobby. It's not a club. I mean, what is it? I think of it as very much akin to a technology. So what is a technology? A technology is a new way of manipulating reality to serve human purposes. And with any technology, you can use it in a positive way that benefits your life while introducing minimal new problems, or you can use it in a way that has a lot of positives and a lot of negatives because you don't really know how to use it, and then you can use it in an overwhelmingly negative way if you just have no clue how to use it. So I think of objectivism as a revolutionary technology. It's a mental technology, but my view of it has for a long time been that people don't have any clue how powerful it is and how to apply it. So I'll give one example of the nature of objectivist principles that I don't think is understood or is rarely understood. And that would be the nature of moral principles, and in particular, principles of action. So in objectivism, that would be virtues. So if you take, say, the principle of independence, what is that? What does that mean? And the model that people typically take for that is a kind of religious model, which is Ayn Rand said, thou shalt be independent. And then you sort of try to figure out what that is, and a lot of times it seems to work, and other times it doesn't seem to work. And then if you hear enough lectures on objectivism, you'll hear about all these different use cases that, oh, well, independence doesn't really mean what you thought it meant, and there's a context, and et cetera, et cetera. But if you look at what Ayn Rand says carefully, what she says is, and this is in Galt's speech, Atlas Shrugged, what she says is, independence is the recognition that, and then for the other virtues she names, you know, honesty is the recognition that. And I remember the first time I read Atlas Shrugged when I was 18, I just sort of thought, well, that just seems pretty arbitrary, just that you have these seven virtues, like what's going on with that. If you read it, I don't have it in front of me, but it's the recognition of something. So what that means is that there's a cause and effect relationship in life. And so with independence, one of the key ones has to do with the fact that you are your only access point to reality. So this has to do with intellectual independence. So that's just a fact. You are your only independent access point to reality. So if you want to, and so your only way of controlling whether what's in your mind is accurate or not is by you using your own mind. If you go by others without using your own mind, you have no way of control whatsoever whether your mental content is accurate. So this is just a fact about the way that the mind works. Now, that fact has implications for action, but the key is that the core of the virtue is the cause and effect relationship, and then the practice of the virtue is the application of that cause and effect relationship along with all of the other relevant cause and effect relationships and along with your goal, so your goal of maximizing your happiness. And I just don't think that's something that's understood, but it's very much in line with it being a technology, with it being a science. It's this set of fundamental identifications about the nature of reality that are crucial for a human being to decide how to live his or her life.
So let's then kind of take a step back, and I want to tell people like this story of how you got introduced to Ayn Rand and then how that played a role in kind of guiding your career. Because I think the stuff that you learned both pre and then post starting the Center for Industrial Progress has, at least for me, been really valuable in thinking about pursuing my own career goals.
Okay, well, I'll start with how I got into objectivism, then maybe I'll pause and then see what we want to focus on in terms of my career. I had a lot of abortive attempts or abortive encounters with Ayn Rand just as a name. I remember when I think the first time I ever heard of Ayn Rand, I was in high school. I was a sophomore, and the teacher announced that there were these essay contests with these books, Anthem, and I particularly remember the title, The Fountainhead. And I just remember not wanting to read it because The Fountainhead seemed like a fantasy book to me, and I hated fantasy books. And I just thought, who would pay people to join an essay contest, to write an essay? That seems like some sort of cult. I later entered and won the Atlas Shrugged essay contest, and my view on the issue changed. But I saw it a couple of times, but the time when I really got into it was I was at Duke University, and I was a freshman, and I had met a couple of freshmen who called themselves objectivists, and I was familiar with the term at the time. I didn't know anything about it, and I certainly wouldn't have called myself one. And you know, they were pretty smart, and I got in some arguments with them, and I had a tough time, and usually I didn't have too tough a time arguing with people, at least people my own age, about politics. So that got me intrigued, and I was in the library on East Campus at Duke trying to study for physics, some physics test, and I didn't really want to. So I saw there this book, Letters of Ayn Rand, as one of the new featured things. It was on one of the main bookshelves. So I started reading that. I remember reading her letter to Barry Goldwater, at least one of them, which was her commentary on the book, The Conscience of a Conservative. And I just remember reading it and thinking, wow, this is a mind. There's just the way she thinks is on another level from all the conservatives or liberals or libertarians that I have been reading. And then when I read Atlas Shrugged shortly thereafter, I just had the same feeling, especially when I would get to the speeches, just that the level of insight that she had was just another level. So if you think of ideas as a form of technology, it's just she was just in a different place than everybody else. I mean, for instance, both in her ability to identify what was true with just this incredible clarity, and also her ability to identify what was false. So I remember reading Francisco's discussion with James Taggart at the beginning of Atlas Shrugged, and Francisco just identifies that him messing up the San Sebastian line was actually completely consistent with the idea that need is a claim on everyone's life, including, and therefore a claim on virtue. And I just thought, oh my gosh, this has been, I've seen this my whole life, but I never noticed it, that everyone is making all these arguments for these policies that are so unjust on the basis of the idea that need is the standard by which we make decisions. So there's just this, I was just really blown away by her way of thinking, and I knew very quickly that whatever she ended up being right or wrong about that, that things would never be the same in terms of just how I thought and what kind of a level of perspective I had access to. And as it turned out, I came to agree with just about everything that she wrote, although a lot of that was, there was a lot of sort of disagreeing and then thinking about it and then talking with people about it and then really seeing, wow, this, my old argument on this was wrong and her argument makes a lot more sense. So when I was 20, I went from deciding that I was going to be a businessman in my life to deciding, well, I need to be some sort of intellectual. I want to be involved with these ideas, and certainly I want to be involved in them from the objectivist philosophical perspective, because that's by far the perspective that made the most sense to me, and still does. So that was really, this was only a 2-year period that I went through this, but because I was pretty intense about learning about all these ideas once I got into it. But when I was 20, I decided that this is whatever I do in life, this is going to be very heavily involved. So I'll stop there as sort of my intellectual introduction. And of course, my life introduction to objectivism, and in parallel to making a career out of it, which most people don't for very good reasons. They're interested in other things. I was very interested and have remained interested in how this can improve my life and how to use this in conjunction with other knowledge that can improve my life.
Yeah, it's. I guess one thing I'd like to do is contrast that kind of with my experience, because so I discovered Ayn Rand when I was 15, and at first the attraction was that I'm going to be able to completely pummel intellectual opponents, because now I have axioms and these unanswerable arguments, and so went into it with a much more kind of argumentative rather than practical cash value interest in the ideas. I'm exaggerating a little bit. I got some sense that this is going to be valuable for my own life. And I've heard you tell stories about a story of when you're at Duke and realizing that focus on, well, how do I answer opponents' arguments actually keeps you from, or makes it much harder to actually get the philosophy and be able to use it in your own life. And I'd love it if you told that story, because I think it really gets to a wrong approach that a lot of people, including myself, have taken.
Yeah, let's see. How do I keep everyone not anonymous in this story? Well, I should mention Gary Hull, who is a professor at Duke, who's a PhD in philosophy and was teaching philosophy, although for various reasons, through the sociology department. But anyway, I got to interact a lot with him. He helped me a lot, and he gave me a lot of one-on-one feedback. But I remember I think I got the most, since I had decided to go into this career and I was very gung-ho, I think I got the most one-on-one feedback from him. But at times there were several of us who would get to talk to Dr. Hull and ask questions. And I noticed an interesting thing with one of my friends who would ask questions, in that he would ask questions in the following format. Dr. Hull, how do I respond when someone says, and that would just whatever way, you know, it's about monopolies. I don't remember the specific issues. For all I know, it could be environmentalism, but there was always this formula of when somebody says X, what do I say? And I noticed that I would be in the same situation as this person. That is, I would get in an argument and it wouldn't go well, whether it was I got pummeled, or maybe it was probably more like I wasn't very convincing to the other person and I would like to be. But I would always come away from that feeling like, well, I guess I don't get that issue clearly enough. So I would say, you know, Dr. Hull, what's wrong with this argument? Or what's the truth about X, however it was? And I realized that with my friend, he's never going to get it. He's never going to get the ideas, and he's never going to be really good at discussion as long as he has this particular attitude, because he's asking, how do I refute the other person? But he doesn't realize that the reason he can't refute the other person is because he himself is not clear. And now that I, for a living, one of the things I do is I train people on communication, I find the same kind of mentality that people start with, and in that they'll say, hey, give me some talking points that I can beat anyone with. Like, just give me three lines that I can use in any conversation, and they'll always work. And I'll say, well, I have some good lines for a lot of different situations, but the only way you're going to know how to use them and know how to say everything else that's necessary in that kind of situation is to have internal clarity. So once you have internal clarity, then it's really good to boil it down and come up with memorable phrases. But you need the clarity first. And as a little advertisement, if anyone goes to energychampion.net, they can see an initial discussion of this. And then we have a full course called How to Talk to Anyone About Energy. But one of the themes of it is there are very, very powerful ways of reframing a discussion and leading somebody to the truth. But the whole precondition of that is that you yourself are confident in your own understanding. And one thing that's very effective in an argument is that you are clear to yourself and to the other person about what you know and what you don't know. Because as soon as you try to pretend that you know something that you don't know, it's a mess for everybody involved, and you shouldn't do that. That's dishonest.
This is Dom Watkins talking with Alex Epstein about objectivism as a tool for success and happiness. If you want to call in, it's 347-324-3075. One common experience among a lot of people is, and I mean, you see this in religion, but I think you also see it amongst people who are interested in Ayn Rand's ideas, which is the feeling of their ideology or their philosophy as a straitjacket that kind of tells them, no, you can't do this thing that you really want to do. And why is it that people fall into that trap, and why is it actually a trap?
So what would be an example of that?
I mean, I think you'll see, for instance, it could be something like, I want to date this person, but for one reason or another, she doesn't measure up to what I think my philosophy tells me I should want.
Well, so it goes back to the idea of what's the philosophy giving you, it is giving you two things. It's giving you clarity about ends and clarity about means. So clarity about ends means, what are you after in life? What is the standard by which you're going to measure whether the outcomes you're getting from your actions are good or bad? And that's a hugely important issue. It's so profound, and it's all over the objectivist literature. And if people read Moral Case for Fossil Fuels, they'll see that getting the issue of standard right, standard of values, it's called in objectivism and in my book, you just realize that it's so uncommonly practiced that is when we're judging, say, how to think about potential global warming, we don't actually do it in any way resembling, let's judge it by the standard of maximizing human well-being. You don't, even though people think, oh, of course I care about human well-being. But the idea of using a standard and having an idea, this is the ultimate test of everything, is so powerful. That said, usually, so that always has to be in mind. And then the other thing it gives you, a philosophy, and particularly objectivism, gives you is means. So here's guidance about the actions, the types of actions that you can take that will promote your life, and the types of actions that you can take that will damage your life in one way or another. Now, it's important to realize that objectivism or any philosophy is not comprehensive. So it's fundamental, but it's not comprehensive. And this is a helpful distinction, at least it has been for me, and it has been for people I've shared it with. So what comprehensive means is that objectivism would give you all the things that you needed to live a successful life, and it would give you guidance on everything that you needed to avoid to live a successful life. Now, there is no document that can possibly contain all of that knowledge, and so much of the knowledge of what's specifically going to be beneficial to your life has to do with, you know, the details of your particular life, but then also specialized knowledge from all kinds of fields. So just take an easy thing like what to eat. You know, what, this is, again, objectivism that tells you what to eat. Now, there's a lot in objectivism in terms of thinking methodology that will help you process the different claims that people make about how to eat. So that's very valuable, but then it's fundamental, right? It's giving you a method for dealing with these concretes, but part of the method is the application of the method involves gaining specialized knowledge, or as much of it as you can, to benefit your life. So one thought is that one test of whether you're using objectivism properly is objectivism making you more eager to gain specialized knowledge? Because if it's making you less eager, that means you're treating it as comprehensive rather than fundamental. And if you look at the nature of the virtues in objectivism, they're really all methodological in one way or another. They're telling you how to be rational in one or another aspect of life. But it's all about how to use your mind to benefit your life. But that requires then gaining all of this particular knowledge. So, okay, remind me what the there's a part of the question that I still haven't addressed. So this is the issue of then straitjacket. I feel like if people feel like it's a straitjacket, they're not looking at it as, here are some crucial cause and effect relationships that have been identified for me so that I can know what the consequences of my actions will be, along with all the other specialized knowledge and person-specific knowledge that I gain. It's just, oh, there's some commandment and that seems disintegrated from my actual situation. But these principles tell you a lot about the consequences of your actions. And the way you should think of it is, there's kind of two different types of what you might call conflict or temptation. I mean, I'm sure there's more, but there's at least two that I can think of off the top of my head. One is just like there's something that's clearly rational, that's clearly in your interest in a certain way, and you feel like your philosophy is holding you back from it. Now, if that's actually true, then the philosophy has to go, or at least a part of the philosophy has to go. So if, let's say you're in a, you know, you think there's a relationship that's going to be really healthy for your life, at least for some amount of time, and you feel like your philosophy is telling you, no, you can't get that, that's, you know, very, you know, that you should really question the philosophical guidance. But what can also happen is, hey, there is a relationship that you really want to have, or that you feel compelled to have. Maybe, you know, the person is super attractive or whatever. There's, you know, you never thought she would go out with you, and it, you know, as a kid, you didn't feel very secure about these things, and then, oh my gosh, she's so beautiful. But you kind of realize that she does not have very good character. Like, it's pretty obvious that there are things wrong with her character. Well, your philosophy is going to tell you a couple of things, including that you cannot evade things like this. You have to be very, very aware of them. And it's also going to tell you things with justice, whereas it happens when you treat people who have very bad character well. And so then your philosophy is the thing that you should be listening to. The philosophy isn't straitjacketing you. It's just saying, hey, look, X, you know, Dave, let's call him Dave. Like, hey, look, these are the principles. This is what is going to happen at some point if you take this course of action. So Dave can say, I don't like that, I want to evade that, but that's precisely why objectivism is very big on being in focus and thinking about things rather than evading them, because I forget the exact line, but, you know, you can evade as in suspend your awareness of reality, but reality does not care. So objectivism is just telling you some really important facts about reality. So that should never be at odds with doing anything that benefits you.
So you mentioned, as an aside, that, you know, most people don't go into intellectual professions. And I think one area in which the idea that philosophy could be of use is greeted with a lot of skepticism would be in business. And so I wonder if you can say a little bit, and we can delve into some detailed stuff after that, about, as you've started, I guess it's been about 5 years now, the Center for Industrial Progress, aside from the actual intellectual content you've produced, how philosophy has kind of helped you or guided you in building a successful business?
Well, there's a sense in which philosophy is viewed as not useful to business, but also a sense in which it is viewed as useful to business. And you'll often hear people talking about, my philosophy of X is, right? You'll hear this in sports as well. Like, what's the defensive coordinator's philosophy? So there's an ever-present need in life to identify fundamentals. And philosophy is really about the deepest fundamentals in human thought and action. So I think that there is a certain kind of appreciation that philosophies are needed, but they're often more concrete philosophies. Like, it's, well, this is a business philosophy, or this is, you know, these are our values. But even they're really getting at philosophical issues. Now, what they're not usually looking to are fundamental philosophies. And often when people are formulating their values, one thing that I've noticed lately, I've been listening to a class on startups. That's a really good class. It's taught at Stanford, and it has a lot of really, really smart people teaching it. But they'll often talk about their core values and how those are absolutely essential in orienting them. And then they sound like philosophers. But then you see, well, how did they come up with those core values? Well, part of it is they'll look at their own experience, and they'll survey different people. And there is importance there in naming your own specific values that aren't just general values. But I haven't heard anyone talk about, hey, you know, we read a couple of philosophers, and that really shed a lot of light on the topic. But why wouldn't you? Because those are the people who are thinking full time about these kinds of issues. So I think it's that the philosophers are not either their ideas are so bizarre that they're not at all useful, that they have negative consequences, or philosophers are not communicating their ideas in a way that is helpful to people. So that I'll tell you one concept, or I'll elaborate on how one concept I already mentioned has been helpful to me, but also helpful to other people that I've talked to in business, and that is the concept of standard of value. Just the idea that with every action we take, we have by implication some idea of how we're measuring good and bad. And so when I'm running my business, doing anything, I'm more successful to the extent I ask myself, well, what's my standard of value in this context? So, for example, if I'm writing columns, you know, I write not as many as you probably these days, but I've written a lot of op-eds in my life. And it took me forever to ask myself, well, what is the standard of value by which I am writing this op-ed? What am I trying to achieve, and why is that good? And that's a good, because that'll determine whether I write it, how I write it, how much I focus on marketing and distribution. And yet it's so easy to go through life without doing that. Now I'm using, for me, an op-ed and everything else I do has a business function, since we're for profit. But it could be, you know, the op-ed, the standard of value is to make money. And then what would you have to do? You'd have to see, well, what are the monetary consequences of writing an op-ed versus not writing an op-ed versus doing all sorts of other things? Or you could say, well, there's another aspect of the business that isn't just about making money, or our ultimate standard of value isn't money, but it, as a byproduct, it makes money. See, all of these things will completely change how you operate. And it's just remarkable how focusing it is to keep reinforcing everything I do has a purpose. Everything I do has a purpose. What is my purpose? And one thing I love is when other people have internalized this, sometimes from talking to me about it a lot, and then they'll remind me. So a friend of mine, I was talking the other day about, I wasn't sure what I wanted to talk about with a business associate. So I had had a certain kind of conflict with a business associate, or perhaps former business associate. And I was just asking him, you know, I'm not sure what to do. I was telling him about my, and he said, well, obviously the first thing to ask yourself is, what is your purpose? I said, oh, that's a really good question. And of course, that is the standard of value question. So it's just that one thing is so powerful, and you can take any idea in objectivism, and it's so powerful too, because what it's doing is it's identifying something, whether it's a standard you're using or a cause and effect relationship that you need to know, that applies in so many different situations.
So I guess this question is at the intersection of the value of a philosophy versus kind of implementing it, which is, I think a lot of people will interested in objectivism, you know, they'll set ambitious goals, or they want to implement new habits or something like that, and they find it really hard. And one of the things I noticed over the evolution, particularly at the beginning of starting out your organization, is that you were really looking at how to, you know, make your own work as efficient and as productive as possible. And so you ended up setting up a lot of systems and gave a course a few years ago on in basically how to make the achievement of your goals inevitable. And I wonder if you can say a little bit about that, because I found that really valuable. I know a lot of people have found it really valuable.
Sure. But let's connect this to some of the issues we were discussing earlier. So yeah, the issue you're talking about here has to do with I've called it different things, but I like often calling it effortless execution, or the piece of the puzzle of how do you actually do things? Because there are a million books that say basically, if you do X, then you'll get result Y. And many of those books are more or less true, but then people have a lot of trouble doing X because it seems to require a lot of willpower. It's not in their habit. So there's this fundamental thing of execution. Okay, so I can give you my own view on that in a second, but just as important, I think, is the fact that I chose to pursue specialized knowledge in this field. So I have, for a long time, studied a lot of the quote-unquote self-help literature and tried out different things, and certain things worked for me and certain didn't, and certain worked, and then I stopped doing them, and then I started doing them again. But this is an example of objectivism leading me to pursue a lot more knowledge than I otherwise would if I didn't have a philosophy, and also helping me organize that knowledge really well. And this is so important when it comes to gaining specialized knowledge, because most books that you read are not very good as writing and as thinking. And in the following respect, at least, they do not properly specify the context in which the ideas that they put forward apply and don't apply. So you wonder, why are there a million different books about productivity? And they all seem to contradict one another. And yet, if you really study them, there are a lot of commonalities. And if you could just take the truth of each one and add it all together, organize it all together, you'd see, oh, wow, there is a big picture where these fit together. But it's the obligation of the writers to make that easier by saying, hey, look, this is what I'm covering. This is what I'm not covering. If you want to get the other thing, go read this other person's book. But instead, they'll act like their thing is the only thing, and they don't really indicate how to integrate it. So I'll give an example of I think one of the better books, but it just came to the top of my head, Getting Things Done by David Allen, which has really, some really, really good points in it, and a lot of people benefit from that book, and I've benefited from that book. But it's not clear to me when I read that book, what are the limits of this? What else is necessary? So as a student of life, so to speak, motivated by and guided by philosophy, what I can do is say, okay, look, I want this knowledge. I have standards by which to evaluate what knowledge is useful or not, but I also have the ability to integrate things and resolve contradictions. And I have this constant premise in my mind that everything does need to integrate and contradictions are not allowed. So the ability, the motivation to seek out the knowledge and the ability to integrate the knowledge is overwhelmingly helped by philosophy. So then there's my own approaches to these. I've become fond of once in a while talking about this kind of issue, and that's more or less what I'm doing on this show today, just telling people what I've learned in my life, but particularly in the last 4 years or so with Center for Industrial Progress, what I've learned in having to do some, I'd say, quite difficult things, having to completely transform myself as a productive entity because I put myself in a situation where I was running a for-profit think tank, which basically doesn't exist anywhere else, and where I was trying to do things like convince businessmen that moral ideas are important and that they should stand up against their attackers, which has been a very difficult thing to do, where I fortunately had success. But you know, those kinds of things took a lot of focus, a lot of productivity, and so they were born out of necessity in part, but they're very useful. So anyway, we can publish links to these. The course Don is mentioning is called Resolution Revolution, and it's got a lot of ideas in it. But one, this is the idea of inevitability, which is really thinking about things in terms of how could I make a certain outcome inevitable? How could I structure my life or structure my environment or both such that it just what I want to happen will automatically happen or as close to automatically happen as possible. So I gave the example in the course, which I still think is a pretty good example. I have an assistant now. I had a different assistant at the time. But I remember I would have just a lot of trouble, as where I used to live, a lot of trouble cleaning my room / office. And this has been a lifelong thing for me. So I just said, you know what? Let's just make a rule where we have a morning call. We don't get off the phone until my room is clean. And that worked amazingly well. And, you know, after a while, at first there was a little bit of resistance, but then I started finding myself even cleaning the room before the call. Not always. Sometimes I had to do it during the call. But I realized that what I had done is I had created a structure whereby all I had to do was answer the phone, and then my commitment would be activated and there would be another person there making it obvious and that I had committed and to it before. And it just made the whole situation much easier. So there are a million examples of how to do this, but the core idea is that you change some condition in your life. You insert it in a way that makes it inevitable that that condition will happen, and then the consequences of that condition will happen. And it just makes stuff a lot easier. And I generally think set up as many conditions as possible that minimize the amount of willpower that you need, because people say willpower is a finite resource. I don't know exactly what that means, but willpower is hard and you need it for a lot of things anyway. So minimize it. And I think you'll see that if you set up the right conditions, you can make the achievement of almost any goal that you can actually do possible.
Yeah, you were mentioning the way in which delving into the self-improvement literature and finding pieces that were valuable and discarding a lot of it, and then the challenge of putting it together. I've encountered a lot of people who will find, well, there's some bad philosophic error in something, and so they'll discard the whole thing. And what's behind that sort of wrong approach, or why do you think that's a wrong approach?
Yeah, I'm really glad you brought up that point. I've seen that a lot. If one thing Facebook gives me is, especially if I don't look at it that often and I have way too many quote-unquote friends on it, but one thing it gives me is a glimpse into, when there are objectivists who are friends of mine, I see a lot of those. I mean, I have a bunch of those on Facebook and I see their posts. I see what you're talking about and in different levels. And it's real. I mean, we could talk about what causes it, but I think we just have to be clear that this is a bizarre attitude. I remember there was a lecture, this is years ago. I mean, I wasn't even at it, but I heard it on tape years ago. I've heard it a couple times. And someone was asking Peter Schwartz, who's an objectivist thinker/writer, about, there was some example of like Hitler and the light bulb. And what had happened, this is the questioners, the weird thing, not Peter, but what if Hitler had invented the light bulb? What would you think of the light bulb? And I remember Peter just said, this is just a magnificent invention. What do you want me to say? Like, the light bulb is a fantastic thing. It doesn't matter who invented it. And that identification, you should get as much value out of as possible. So what you're going to find is that a lot of people who identify really, really important things do not agree with you on philosophic fundamentals, particularly if you adhere to a revolutionary philosophy that they either haven't been exposed to or disagree with superficially or don't understand or whatever. So it's the only thing to keep in mind there is that with their wrong philosophy, it's going to make it harder for them to identify the truth in a precise way. It's going to often lead to certain kinds of errors. In certain cases, the methodology can be so off that knowledge that seems to be knowledge or that's presented as knowledge is really not knowledge. So it makes it harder. But the key thing is to use your awareness of philosophy as a means of actually figuring out what's true and not true. But you have to be on the premise that most of the truth out there has been discovered by people without the same philosophy as you have. And you want to find as much of that as possible. So things that I am into, like I'm into meditation, that I think there's certain fundamental identifications that are true. And then there's lots of connection to Indian mysticism. But I can separate that out and look at the truth. But people say, oh, meditation, that's just Indian mysticism. And it just doesn't make any sense. I mean, it doesn't make any sense to embrace something because Indian mysticism, for sure, but it's really, I don't fully understand it, except that I think my sense is that it comes from, or that it's connected to, this idea of objectivism as comprehensive versus fundamental. Because if you view objectivism as fundamental, then you're thirsty for all the knowledge you can get in a different domain. And it's just, you know, the bad stuff is just, it's just a pain because you have to separate it out. But you're always hungry for the good stuff.
So that whole, like, judging human products reminds me of the broader challenge of how, what it means to judge other people. And I think this is certainly an area where I think it's really easy to go wrong and get what Ayn Rand is saying very wrong. So the kind of template example is, you know, you discover objectivism and you're, you know, 20 years old, you denounce everyone around you, and, you know, nobody likes you. And that's definitely not what it calls for. But what do you see as some of the challenges of understanding the objectivist view of moral judgment and how it applies to human relationships?
Well, I think that what happens is people look at the virtues of objectivism, and then they look at the necessity of judgment, and then they basically go to, if you don't practice all the virtues, then you must be immoral. But that would mean that you, the judger, were immoral before you knew the virtues. So that's one thing, is that you have to get at what, in order to judge someone as immoral, one of the ideas is, well, they have to have done something wrong that they had a choice over. Otherwise, it's not an issue of moral versus immoral. And this goes to the objectivist understanding of free will and the moral implications of that. So the idea, well, you have this choice to think or not to think, or to focus or not to focus. And that what's going on with immorality is largely evasion. So when you're looking at somebody, a lot of your, what you're trying to do is to figure out, is this person honestly committed to thinking about reality, or are they evading? So I think there's just a lot of misunderstanding in, and that has to do with, how do you judge that? Well, sometimes you don't know. And that's one important thing that I'll get to in a second. But to the extent you can, it has to be based on, well, what do they have access to? So if, for instance, we took the example of Dave earlier, who wants to date the beautiful but sort of train wreck girl who's, you know, going to head for disaster because of her bad character, and you know, we tell him, look, Dave, this is the situation. Look, it's going to happen. And he goes ahead. Well, you can say that was not a moral thing that he did. Now, there's also the issue of, well, what is it to do one moral, immoral thing? Does that make you immoral? So there are all these different categories, and there's some good objectivist material on all of these things. I think if you look at the novels of Ayn Rand, you'll see that there's a lot of nuance to how people are making judgments. But the thing I referred to earlier is also important, that you often do not know enough to judge somebody. And this goes also to the issue of standard of value or purpose. What is your purpose in judging somebody? And usually what's happening is, if this person is sort of over-judging, is their purpose is to be superior to people. So if your purpose is to feel superior to people, yeah, then you're going to constantly look for negative things about them and then compare yourself favorably to them. But that is not a legitimate purpose at all, and it's completely at odds with the virtue of independence and pursuit of happiness. So I think most of the time, at least this is how I experience it, with most people, I don't feel like I know enough about to have much of a judgment about them, and I try to gain more information when I have a reason to have judgments about them. And that also includes, it's not just it's not just, again, it's the philosophy is fundamental, not comprehensive. So it's not just, you know, their virtue from a philosophical perspective, but it's things such as, well, psychological things. You know, if I had kids and I was hiring a babysitter, I would look at that kind of thing. In business, I want to look at business acumen. If it's an employee, I'm really interested in judging things like intelligence, reliability. So again, so there's a lot in what I just said, but it all comes back to this is a fundamental guide that identifies these fundamental truths about the way that life works. And if you take it that way, and if you really pursue a positive purpose, and you're on the premise of gaining specialized knowledge you need for any given undertaking, I think you'll be okay.
So there's one more kind of question then that, you know, we just talked about judging other people. My favorite paragraph in Galt's speech is the paragraph on pride, which just has amazing points and just some gorgeous writing. But, you know, one of the points that Ayn Rand makes is that moral perfection is possible and that it's what you should do. And I think that is both a very empowering thing, but it can be for people a really scary thing. And if they take it the wrong way, it can be, I think, a harmful idea, because if they find themselves, I made an irrational choice, or I evaded, or I did something I regard as immoral, they can, in effect, the level of guilt can almost be paralyzing. And I'm curious how in your own mind you think of the idea of moral perfection, and whether that's actually the way in which you think about your choices and your goals.
That is a good question. Well, I want to bring up there's a Q&A period. It's one of the ones in the Philosophy of Objectivism course, which was taught in 1976 by Leonard Peikoff and was the basis for the book, which came out in 1991, Objectivism, the Philosophy of Ayn Rand. And Ayn Rand, unless I'm mistaken, and I have a pretty good memory for these Q&A periods, she talks about perfection as a dangerous concept. And she doesn't say moral perfection as a dangerous concept, I don't think. But so I think perfection is a dangerous concept. So I can talk about there's a lot to that. You can think about it, but just in terms of it can be very Platonic in nature. So you're putting up some reality, in non-existent reality. You're saying this is the way things should be, and I'm not it, and there's something wrong with that. So, but here's the way I think of that virtue, and then I can talk about how it applies to, well, another thing that I think is important. I think of it as perfecting, you know, you're perfecting your character. So, I mean, perfecting is better than perfect in many ways. But a lot of what pride gets to is that you're focused on your moral character as a goal, not as an end in itself, but as something that you are thinking about a lot and you are improving all the time. So what it's saying is, with regard to, you know, the virtues and the values, you know, your own character, you know, which is your characteristic way of dealing with those, that's something that you want to improve all the time. And you want to be aware of ways in which it might be deficient. So it takes, you know, a good character is a matter of habit, of developing something over time. So I think it's an important idea to look at one's character and say, look, what more important asset do I have than my character? I want to make sure that I'm developing it as well as possible. And then there, the rest of the philosophy is very, very helpful. Versus saying, well, I have this image in my mind of moral perfection. Here's what it looks like. And then I'm going to sort of pursue that. I don't find that too helpful. Going back to the topic of perfection, part of the reason why it's dangerous is that what it is, it's not at all what life consists of. I mean, life consists of pursuing different goals and constantly thinking about how to pursue them better and constantly taking action and constantly getting things wrong. And if you run a business, I mean constantly getting things wrong. And if you have the idea that you, quote, should be perfect in any of these concrete realms, it's just a disaster. Now, if you have the idea that you can just remain imperfect at any given thing and that that's okay, that's also disastrous. But there's an expression by this guy, Dan Sullivan, a business guru, who talks about progress, not perfection, which I think is a helpful kind of concept in business. But it's important that life is just full of mistakes. And to address another defect in people's understanding of objectivism, it's full of uncertainty. So there's a sense in which you seek certainty, particularly for more scientific knowledge that's more static in nature, like the law of universal gravitation or something like that. But in terms of the kind of knowledge that you're dealing with every day, which has to do with knowledge of specifics in life that are changing all the time because people and institutions and technologies are changing all the time, you're constantly acting in the face of uncertainty, which means you're constantly thinking in the face of uncertainty. And you have to be really good at that. So you're sort of constantly imperfect with respect to the achievement of your goals, and you're constantly uncertain with respect to the achievement of your goals. And that's not at all at odds with objectivism. Objectivism is a tool for maximizing how well you can think and thus how well you can deal with uncertainty and improving yourself all the time. But if you have any illusions that's not okay, that life is meant to be certain all the time, or that you're meant to be perfect at everything you need to do, then it's objectivism is going to slow you down rather than speed you up. And so just as it's objectivism should be if it's fundamental, not comprehensive, it should be a motivation to gain more specialized knowledge, not demotivation. It should be, it should help you deal with and completely confront a life which is necessarily uncertain and imperfect with respect to the goals that you're pursuing.
Alex, how can people find out about your work and follow you online?
Well, industrialprogress.com is our main website. Unfortunately, I have to give you some other websites because it's imperfect. Let's just say that. But it will be more perfect in the future. But the book, Moral Case for Fossil Fuels, you can find at moralcaseforfossilfuels.com. And our course, How to Talk to Anyone About Energy, is at energychampion.net. And then I can be found on the usual social media channels, particularly Twitter and Facebook. But if you want one catch-all, I'd say go to industrialprogress.com and enter your email address on the right side to get our newsletter, and that'll give you the information that you need.
Thanks to Alex Epstein. This is Don Watkins on the Yaron Brooks Show, and we will be right back after a short break.
With adoring fans, rabid critics, and very few in between, why does Atlas Shrugged evoke such impassioned responses? Because it grapples with the fundamental problems of human existence and it presents radically new answers. Atlas Shrugged challenges many conventional notions about good and evil, that sex is a low animal desire, that money is the root of evil, that man is sinful by nature. One of the most prominent is the notion that selfishness is evil and self-sacrifice is good. Atlas Shrugged is a dramatization of Ayn Rand's unique vision of existence and of man's highest potential. 12 years in the writing, it is her masterwork. Rand's worldview emerges in the plot turns of this compelling mystery, centered on one question: who is John Galt? There are many legends. Which of these is true? Is he the man who discovered the Fountain of Youth? The man who found the lost city of Atlantis? A modern Prometheus? Does he even exist? And why, if no one knows the answer, does the entire world know his name? Find out the answer when you read the novel that sparked a philosophical revolution. Order it today on Amazon.com.
The Ayn Rand Institute campus is an exciting online destination offering free e-courses on Ayn Rand and her revolutionary philosophy of objectivism. Whether you recently picked up your first Rand book or have been reading her novels and nonfiction for years, ARI Campus has something for you. On campus, you'll discover a variety of multimedia courses covering Rand's literary classics, specific aspects of thought, and how to apply her ideas to your life. Get started today at campus.aynrand.org. See you on campus.
In 1934, Ayn Rand wrote to journalist and essayist H.L. Mencken, "Perhaps it may seem a lost cause at present, and there are those who will say that I am too late, that I can only hope to be the last fighter for a mode of thinking which has no place in the future. But I do not think so. I intend to be the first one in a new battle, which the world needs as it has never needed before, the first to answer the many too many advocates of collectivism and answer them in a manner which will not be forgotten. Every day at ARI, we work to make sure that Ayn Rand's answer will not be forgotten. Help us. Contribute today at AynRand.org/support.
The Ayn Rand Institute's mission is to promote Ayn Rand's philosophy of reason, rational self-interest, and laissez-faire capitalism. We are currently looking for talented, passionate, and bright people who share our goal of advancing Ayn Rand's ideas in the world. The Ayn Rand Institute offers you the opportunity to impact the culture and make a difference each and every day. If you're interested in working at the Ayn Rand Institute, visit us at AynRand.org today. There you'll find details on employment opportunities and how to apply.
Every day we hear from political leaders that the American dream is vanishing because of rising income inequality. The rich are getting richer by rigging the system, leaving the rest of us to struggle to get by. To save the American dream, we're told that we need to fight inequality through tax hikes, wealth redistribution schemes, and a far higher minimum wage. But what if that narrative is wrong? What if the real threat to the American dream is not rising inequality, but forced equality? In their forthcoming book, Equal is Unfair, America's Misguided Fight Against Income Inequality, Don Watkins and Yaron Brook reveal that almost everything we've been taught about inequality is wrong. You'll discover why successful CEOs make so much money and why they should, how the minimum wage hurts the very people it claims to help, why claims of middle-class stagnation are a myth, and more. For more information or to pre-order the book, Equal is Unfair, visit your favorite bookseller or go to Amazon.com.
Sitting in for Yaron Brook and the Yaron Brook Show, we've been talking about objectivism as a tool for success and happiness. In the first segment, we had Alex Epstein from the Center for Industrial Progress giving his kind of insight onto this issue. And if you want to call in, you can call in at 347-324-3075. I received a couple of questions in preparation for this program that bear on the theme. And one I wanted to take at the outset came from Ezra Drake. And he asks, from a psychological perspective, what is it like applying objectivism to your life? And I mean, that is a question you could write 100 books on. I want to focus on one aspect that I don't think gets talked about enough, and that's what it's like applying objectivism in a context where you feel you haven't lived up to it. And so I'll just share a story from my past. Many years ago, I was dating a girl, and it became clear to me relatively early on that it wasn't going to work. And, you know, but at that point we had already said, I love you. And it was pretty serious. And it took quite a while before I broke things off. And so during all this time, I'm continuing to say I'm happy in the relationship, continuing to say that I love her. And it was, you know, I don't want to hurt her feelings. I don't want to feel like a bad guy, but I also knew that this was not a good thing. And so that kind of raises a couple possibilities, because clearly this is, you know, I have a philosophy that's kind of guiding me in one direction and I've gone another direction. And then thinking about why is that? Well, one reason is that you're not really convinced of what your philosophy says or what you think the philosophy implies for this particular situation. And Alex in our last segment talked a lot about that, about the difficulty of really getting clear on what your philosophy actually says so that you can actually apply it. Now, in this case, when I thought about it, you know, did I really see and understand the virtue of honesty and what it required in this situation. And I concluded, yeah, I do. It's not, well, I'm really confused about whether or not this virtue is a virtue, whether it will actually be to my benefit in the long run. The other possibility then in those kinds of cases is that you're surrendering your own happiness as your goal. It's, I see this cause and effect relationship between honesty and my own happiness, but then what's going on in those cases, I'm surrendering my happiness as my goal. And this can sound kind of funny, I think, even to non-objectivists, the idea of they can picture a certain kind of person who's surrendering happiness as a goal, right? It's the person who explicitly rejects it, the Mother Teresa who says, no, I'm going to put service to God, or I'm going to put service to society above my happiness. But I think the phenomenon of surrendering your own happiness as your ultimate goal is way more pervasive and can even happen to objectivists. And the way it happens, I think, is through what Ayn Rand calls motivation by fear. So Ingalls' speech, he has a really profound and insightful discussion of what she calls motivation by love versus motivation by fear, or the idea of I want to achieve the values that make my life possible versus I want to avoid negatives, I want to avoid pain, I want to avoid discomfort. And motivation by fear was like in this particular case, what was going on was simply I was surrendering my own happiness in the name of a short-term avoiding the discomfort and, you know, the guilt that comes with breaking up with somebody who, you know, you think is a good person, but isn't right for you. And I think that is really common. And it's sometimes you have to really think about, is that what I'm doing? Maybe you've heard this idea that everybody's selfish, what in philosophy is called psychological egoism. And one reason why I think this can be plausible to people is because it can always feel like, yeah, I'm doing whatever will make me happy. It would make me unhappy to have a tough conversation with somebody when I can put it off until tomorrow or until the next week. And part of Ayn Rand's point is that, no, there is a qualitative difference between valuing your actual long-range happiness and trying to achieve it by achieving the values that it requires versus escaping or avoiding pain and discomfort. The key takeaway from that discussion is, though, that you shouldn't be thinking in terms of I'm not living up to my philosophy. So this is the kind of main psychological point, which is that if the feeling is I'm not living up to my philosophy, you're on the wrong premise because you don't exist to serve your philosophy. Your philosophy exists to serve you. It should be, as Alex said, a technology that you're using to achieve your happiness. And so to take the question again, what is it like psychologically applying objectivism to my life? It's the opposite of a religion. It's the opposite of treating philosophy as something you have to live up to. In a religion, you have an impossible ideal that you have to live up to, and then you have to feel guilty because you can't live up to it. And with objectivism, it's that you have an ideal, a personal ideal, an ideal that is valuable to you of your own happiness. And then the hard work goes into A, using that tool, figuring out what the philosophy actually says and then how it actually applies, and then B, maintaining a commitment to your own happiness even when it gets hard. And in a sense, I think that in many cases that's the hardest thing and where people go wrong. Justin Wisniewski has a question. A term I've always struggled to fully grasp is psychoepistemology. I think I understand it, but I'm not 100% certain. Can you explain this in a simple way? So in a certain way, this is kind of a more technical question, but I think it fits into what we've been talking about because I do think that understanding what Ayn Rand means by this concept and then exploring kind of how she thinks about it is really, really valuable in life. And an analogy that I came up with today that I think captures it is you can think about driving. So on the one hand, you know, you have a driving manual and it gives you the rules for proper driving and, you know, how far away should I stay from other cars and so on. And when we're learning, though, and we're trying to implement those principles, we develop certain habits, a certain way of driving that over time becomes automatic. We each have kind of a different habitual style of driving. So some people are, you know, if they're not paying attention, they're just going to end up in the right lane, going the speed limit, a lot of length between their car and the car in front of them. And then other people are more on the aggressive side, where they're going to be driving fast. That, you know, the idea of I have a lead foot, changing lanes a lot, following people closely, slamming on their brakes. And Ayn Rand would say that there's an equivalent in your kind of habitual way of driving. There's an equivalent in thinking. There's your habitual way of using your mind. And so if epistemology, the theory of knowledge, is kind of like the driver book that tells you the right way to drive a car, the right way to use your mind in order to get knowledge, you also have your automatic style, your habitual style of using your mind. And that is what she would call your psychoepistemology. And so the you're not locked into that habitual way of thinking. Or let me come back to that. Let me give you an example of what she has in mind. So when you hear a new idea or a new argument, like, what is the first thing your mind does? Now, some people, you'll encounter this a lot by people in philosophy, in academia, in graduate school. The first time there's any idea, the first thing their mind does is search for counterexamples. Say that reason is men's means of survival. Well, here's some irrational people who are alive, so therefore we can throw out your idea. So that's one kind of psychoepistemology. Another kind, and this is very pervasive, and certainly in the past was pervasive in objectivism, is you start trying to connect abstract ideas to abstract ideas. So, you know, is honesty a virtue, or why is honesty a virtue? Well, honesty means no pretense. Virtue is the principles required for man's life. The basic principle is rationality, and rationality says recognize reality, and therefore you shouldn't fake reality, and therefore honesty is a virtue. So it's a chain of these just super abstract concepts that don't actually capture reality. They're what Ayn Rand calls floating abstractions. And this whole way of processing is what objectivists call rationalism. And so we can have these kind of automatic, habitual ways of thinking. But just as if we in driving, you can be a very aggressive driver, drive really fast, but maybe you get into a car accident or you get a speeding ticket and you think, you know, I really need to change the way I'm driving because this way is making my life worse. It's harder to get the places where I want to go safely and without tickets. And so you can retrain yourself. You can go back to that driver guidebook and you can consciously and conscientiously try to abide by the rules. And over time, you can gain new habits that will make you a better driver. The same thing is true of psychoepistemology. It's that if you find that your method of thinking is not leading you to knowledge or it's making it really hard to reach knowledge, you can go back and study the principles of epistemology, the principles of clear thinking, and through effort and application over time, you can retrain your mind and have a better habitual way of thinking. The thing is that, though, that it takes effort. It takes time. You have to actually practice it. It doesn't matter how many books on epistemology or even books or lectures on psychoepistemology you read. It means actually implementing those in practice. But if you do, the result is that you'll find it easier to gain knowledge. You'll be able to gain more knowledge, and then that will have all of the benefits that knowledge has. So we're going to take a quick break and then come back and end on a positive. So stay tuned.
Ayn Rand was a radical thinker whose philosophical novels challenged students to reconsider their views on fundamental issues. The Fountainhead, Atlas Shrugged, and Anthem. These works have become classics of American literature that never fail to engage young people and stimulate intense classroom discussion. By offering these works for free to teachers, the Ayn Rand Institute hopes to encourage greater awareness and understanding of Rand's stimulating perspective. If you're a teacher who would like Ayn Rand's books in your classroom, visit AynRand.org. This is at no cost to you. Go to AynRand.org today.
When The Fountainhead was first published more than 70 years ago, Ayn Rand's bold literary vision and groundbreaking philosophy of individualism captured the world's attention. Initially rejected by 12 publishers as too intellectual, the novel became an instant classic and continues to provoke heated debates. What motivates a creative thinker? Is it a selfless desire to benefit mankind, a hunger for fame, fortune, and accolades, the need to prove superiority, or is it a self-sufficient drive to pursue a creative vision independent of others' needs or opinions? Ayn Rand addresses these questions through her portrayal of Howard Roark, an innovative architect who, as she puts, struggles for the integrity of his creative work against every form of social opposition. It's also the story of his love affair with a woman who seeks to defeat him. The Fountainhead is as relevant today as it was when Rand first penned it. The novel was also a personal landmark for Rand. In Howard Roark, she presented for the first time the uniquely Ayn Rand hero, man as he could be and ought to be. Order your copy today at Amazon.com.
You didn't build that. You don't pay your fair share. Who do you think you are? Ayn Rand knew exactly who you are. Rational, productive, independent. You work hard and use your own judgment. You choose your career path, your lifestyle, your values. You're living the American dream. And now you see that there are people who want to take away what you've created and who will call their lust to loot a virtue. People who think the needs of others is a claim on your money, your work, your life. Well, how can you fight back? That's what they do at the Ayn Rand Institute. They look closely at public policy beyond sound bites and election cycles, at the fundamental moral ideas that frame crucial debates. They focus on reframing the issues in line with reason, egoism, and individual rights to life, liberty, property, and the pursuit of happiness. Your life, liberty, property, and the pursuit of your happiness. Stand up with them to fight against the sacrifice of your values by making a contribution today at AynRand.org/support. They'll use your money to defend your values.
Every day we hear from political leaders that the American dream is vanishing because of rising income inequality. The rich are getting richer by rigging the system, leaving the rest of us to struggle to get by. To save the American dream, we're told that we need to fight inequality through tax hikes, wealth redistribution schemes, and a far higher minimum wage. But what if that narrative is wrong? What if the real threat to the American dream is not rising inequality, but forced equality? In their forthcoming book, Equal is Unfair, America's Misguided Fight Against Income Inequality, Don Watkins and Yaron Brook reveal that almost everything we've been taught about inequality is wrong. You'll discover why successful CEOs make so much money and why they should, how the minimum wage hurts the very people it claims to help, why claims of middle-class stagnation are a myth, and more. For more information or to pre-order the book, Equal is Unfair, visit your favorite bookseller or go to Amazon.com.
This is the Yaron Brook Show. I'm Don Watkins sitting in for Yaron Brook. We've been talking today about objectivism as a tool for success and happiness. As we get close to the end, though, I want to talk a little bit about Yaron's book, my book, Equal is Unfair, America's Misguided Fight Against Income Inequality. And to connect it to our topic, I want to talk about kind of like my personal motivation for writing it. So since I was young, before I discovered Ayn Rand, and I discovered her when I was 15, so we're talking, you know, my early teens, I've always been just really obsessed with human excellence in any field. So whether it was learning about scientists like Darwin or Einstein, or learning about great artists like Ayn Rand or Victor Hugo or Michelangelo, whether it was just great entertainers like Steve Martin or Jerry Seinfeld or J.K. Rowling, I was always just very interested in excellence and noticing the kind of commonalities between geniuses in every field and just learning about how they went about doing what they did. And it was always very striking to me, the contrast between how we view excellence in those fields or in sports or something versus how we view excellence in business. So my background was actually in business. That was what I got my undergrad in, and that's what I was doing before I came to work at the Ayn Rand Institute. And certainly this is not my own observation, but Ayn Rand pointed out, but I saw all around me, it wasn't just that business excellence, people who were the greatest achievers in industry, in invention, it's not simply that they were ignored or that they weren't kind of appreciated as much as a great athlete. It was really the opposite, that the best were treated as robber barons, as greedy exploiters. And this is just the most horrific injustice, because if anything, their excellence contributes the most to our lives. I mean, if you think about everything good in your life, a lot of it comes from these great minds, particularly in business, whether it's the people who made it possible for you to have indoor plumbing or lights or to be able to travel across the country to see friends, to have enough food to eat. All of it's made possible by the kind of exemplar, the peak performers in business. And so it has really been my mission to do what I can to remedy that injustice, because I think, like, if I was going to have whether it's my first book with Euron, Free Market Revolution, where we're really trying to lay out that business is something moral and that capitalism is moral precisely because it protects business, to our new book, which is really looking at the number one attack today on business achievement, the basic goal of my writing has always been to help create a world where we celebrate Bill Gates's business achievements in the same way that we celebrate Michael Jordan's basketball achievements. So which is another way of saying that the book is not primarily political, even though it talks a lot about politics and it talks a lot about economics. It's really about justice for the great producers, the individuals whose excellence makes our lives better and whose example provides something really valuable for us to emulate. Now, a lot of the talks I've given and will be given on inequality are going to focus on the political angle, understandably enough, given our context. But I recently gave a talk for Strive conferences called Vilifying Ambition. And what I really focused on was the question was, even if the ideas propagated by the inequality alarmists, even if those ideas were never implemented in public policy, they would still be really destructive. And that video is now up on YouTube. If you Google Don Watkins Vilifying Ambition, or if you go to the Strive Club's YouTube channel, you can find it there. Encourage you to watch it. Feel free to send me your feedback, positive, negative, and hopefully if you think it's positive, share it with people. So as we're wrapping up, we always like to talk about something good, uplifting, and so I'm going to tell a little bit of a story that starts about 9 years ago when I just moved to Southern California. I had some friends who had their own friends who were in a band, and so they invited me to this small little music venue up in L.A. And as a general rule, I don't respond to music the first time I'm hearing about it, even if it's like the easiest, most candy bubblegum pop where you can just process it automatically. It takes me a few listens, and so I don't often get a lot out of going to see live music where I don't already know the artist. But in this particular case, there was like an opening artist named Sarah Bareilles, who I thought, yeah, that actually sounds pretty cool. And so on a lark, I went and bought the CD that she was selling on the way out. And this was, you know, a self-produced CD for a local LA artist. And I just, for the next, I guess, month, I was listening to it nonstop. I thought, this is really amazing. And I started telling all my friends and family, like, she's going to be the next big thing. And I just got these knowing looks that said, uh-huh. Everybody thinks their, you know, local band and, you know, their secret favorite band is going to blow up. Ha, 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 ha. So about a year later, she has an album. Sarah Bareilles has an album that's her first major label release is about to come out. And I had got to chat with her a little bit because, you know, she would play these small venues in L.A. and maybe 100 or 200 people would be there. And I knew that, all right, this album is going to be explosive, and so this is probably my last chance to see her live and in a small kind of venue. And I remember that it, you know, the concert's going on, and she had played, and it was a great show. And I thought, well, I want to get something by her sign because, you know, it'll be nice and permanent. It's probably my last chance. So I get in line at the booth where they're selling T-shirts, and I'm standing there for like 5 minutes, and there's this girl in front of me who just, like, she's just chatting with the guy selling T-shirts, not actually buying anything. And so I'm getting a little frustrated. And so finally, in not necessarily the most polite way, I kind of shoved her to the side so I could get up there and buy my T-shirt. And I turn and I look at her, and I realize that I have just shoved Sarah Bareilles out of the way so I could buy a Sarah Bareilles poster to get signed by Sarah Bareilles. thankfully, she thought this was more funny than offensive, and we had a nice little chat, and I did get the poster sign. But it turns out that she actually did go on to become super successful with her single off that first album, Love Song, more recently her song Brave, and then this I'm completely excited about, which is a new Broadway musical that she did the music for based on a movie that I love and adore, Waitress. And the soundtrack for that's out. I haven't seen the play yet. It opens in April, I guess it is, on Broadway. But basically, if you like anything that is pop but more blues and jazz inspired, I think Sarah Bareilles is amazing as a songwriter. Her lyrics are just outright poetry, and her voice is incredible. So that is my recommendation for this episode. Thank you for tuning in. That is your On Brooke Show. Look forward to hearing your feedback and hope that you will share this with your friends. If you want to learn more about Equal is Unfair, you can go to equalisunfair.com. And to learn more about the Ayn Rand Institute and all of the projects that we're up to, go to aynrand.org. You can follow me on Twitter at dwatkins and the number 3. And Yaron Brooke will be back with you next time. Till then.
Forward.